I should have said the poet. I should have said the poet. The poet.
Sending poets. This is Sending Poets, a podcast about ideas. Our goal is to understand metaphorical truths within the beauty we find in the human experience. My name is John. With me is Bob. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, John.
And Tucker. What's up, Tucker?
Good morning, gentlemen.
And we are continuing our conversation on the 2023 Holberg debate. Does consciousness extend beyond brains? So, real quick follow-up from last episode, Kim and I tried the staring test on Rupert Sheldrake's website. It is kind of described as an app, but it's not like a traditional app that you would download. It's just on the website. But it was pretty cool. I'd like to try it again. It's 20. So, I don't know if we went into detail about it. It's basically 20 iterations one person is the subject and one person is the looker, and it's synced. Like, you have two people, each person is using their phone on his website. There's a QR code so it can sync up, which is neat, right? But one iteration is the looker, you know, they're on their phone, they're getting prompted, stare at the subject or don't stare at the subject. And it says, like, when you don't stare, it's like, even close your eyes and think about somebody else. But when you're staring at the subject, and by the way, the subject's back is to you. That's how this works. So you're staring at their back, and you're really supposed to be, you know, with intent, just focusing on looking straight at that person. The subject, whose back is to the looker, the subject is looking at their phone. And for each iteration, they're just prompted. There's a countdown, and it's like, just touch, yes or no, I'm being stared at. And so it does that 20 times. Now, when Kim did it, she was sitting on a couch, and I can only see the back of her head. And I was wondering, like, if I am projecting some kind of energy, you know, if that's how this works, that she could feel the energy that I'm radiating out of my eyes. I thought, I could only see the back of her head. Like, most of her body is blocked by this chair. So I was really interested to try again sometime where I could see her full, like, maybe we're just standing there or something, but didn't try that yet. Anyway, the results were 50-50. Like, she got 10 out of 20 correct. Then we flipped the roles. And in this case, we were sitting kind of on the couch. She could see my whole back. So there wasn't a chair blocking the way, and it was the same thing, 10 out of 20, 50-50. So it was cool. I would like to keep trying it. I didn't know what to expect, but
I have a question. Is the prompting of the person who's staring or not staring, are they choosing to stare or not stare, or are they prompted by the app itself?
They're prompted, and that's how it knows, you know, like, this is, you know, I would say it's a fun thing, but obviously it's easy to, you know, ruin the results. I would say if you're going to, because the thing is, like, he tracks this, you know, you don't have to log in. There's no data being like personal data or, you know, anything that you have to worry about. It's just here's the results from these 20 iterations, you know. The looker was prompted to stare. The subject felt like they were being stared at. Yes or no, 20 times.
So the result is random chance between two choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, he's done like thousands of these. I think I expect, you know, in the debate, he mentions the results from these tests. I expect the results he's referring to are a much more controlled thing that, you know, he had, you know, in a laboratory setting, I suppose. You know, at the same time, I do think it's really neat that he just made this really easy thing accessible for anyone to try.
Yeah,
and cool. Yeah, and
but
I
do have concerns though about the decision making component. Meaning, maybe the just arguing randomly here, maybe the magic happens when the person who's connected to the other person, or there's intent between the other person, like it's. They're looking at you for a reason, right? Like when he talked about the private detective, you don't stare at the guy's back. Well, the private detective is chasing you for a reason. You know,
yeah.
He's got ill intent. Maybe it's like a serial killer. And you feel like when you're alone at home, like there's a serial killer looking at you. Well, maybe that's different than just your loving partner or your mom or your dad or something looking at you. You know what I mean? Like maybe the intent,
yeah.
It's not just looking through eyes at someone, but when you turn it up to 10, something happens. That would be my thing. And then number two would be, is he going to release results that show it is a 50-50 thing? Because like I feel like all the little hits get amplified. And this is part of just the generic, you know, throwing cold water, being a disbeliever, a skeptic, right? You have to ask, are these going to be selective results? Do we only look at the, you know, the times when it hits and never the times when it misses.
Yeah, cognitive bias, kind of like is what I think it's going to be.
Confirmation bias.
Exactly. Yeah, sorry, that's the yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and there's two things for me would be if this is something that's actually happened, it's a form of sense. Is that a skill that can be developed? Both as you projecting your will as the starer, but also as the person being stared at, is that a sense you can develop?
That's a good point. Yeah.
That somebody is staring at you. But then the second thing, and it kind of touches on what Bob says, is the intent. Now, most of the time when people feel like they sense that somebody's staring at them, it's kind of a creepy thing.
Mm.
And is it because the person doing the staring is projecting this very intense emotion, whether it's lust or violence or ill will? Does it become more palpable to the person sensing it because there's that intense
feeling
connected to it?
How about does it start with the feels like someone wants to eat you? I mean, let's go back to the beginning.
No,
I'm serious.
You're right.
The evolutionary theory here is very interesting in that through much of our existence, it would be a powerful sense, back to what Tucker was saying also, with feeling like what it feels like to be the stare versus being stared at. Can you modify both of those? Because having an, I would think of, here's how pressurized it would be, evolutionarily speaking. The pressure is, if you miss on this one time, you're dead. Like in the jungle laws kind of thing, you know, nature, red in tooth and claw. I mean, we're talking about you're out there through, let's say, the last 500,000 years, everything but the last 15,000, let's just say, something like that. So almost all of our time, no justice system, no NCIS, no fingerprints. Uh-huh. You would just be so easily gone or dealt with, and that would be it. And so the pressure is all about, meaning if you had an adaptive fitness to be able to feel malintent through the gaze, like that's the weakness, is that wherever they're looking at is the focal point of the malintent, and it can be felt like the eye of Sauron. That's uh-huh. the contention, I think. It would have to be literally, you know, it happened in our history because we were preyed upon by, you know, predatory cats and other humans and all the rest. That's another thing. Does this happen with animals? I would go to like an animal model, start with mice, start with cats, you know, start with something that is controllable in an ethical sense. You can put them in a cage. Here's the problem with the phone thing, man, is there's people with chairs and there's people with couches and there's people who are naked. There's people who are drunk. There's people who are hot. Like, you have no control over what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
You need to put this thing in a cage.
Yeah. There's people that would just because what is the line from The Dark Knight? Some people just want to watch the world burn. There's people that would just be like intentionally fucking up the results because they think it's funny, right? Yeah.
Well, and going back to the emotional part of it, I mean, it does go back to our earlier days where it's like there's something in our brain that says if a deer is staring at me, that's fine. But if a mountain lion is staring at me, that's not. And how subconscious that is. Like, I would be willing to bet that a child, if they were able to put it into words correctly, would innately know, I felt something when that cat stared at me that I did not feel when that deer stared at me.
Yeah.
And no one has taught me why that is.
Well, I'll throw this at you and tell me if this sounds right. The field of vision, having eyes on the front of your head versus on the side of your head, tells us everything about you. Everything. There is a trade-off, obviously, with having eyes on the side of your head in that you get much wider field of vision, but you trade off on depth perception. And predatory animals feed, pun intended, off of depth perception. Their ability to judge very, very precisely in a binocular sense where their prey is, and we're assuming that, you know, they're hunting off of sight. So, you know, predatory birds, you know, predatory cats, you know, sight hunters. The eyes in the front of your head would be such a tell, I think, on an evolutionary standpoint, meaning I think we talked about like snakes maybe once upon a time, and like jumping at the sight of a snake doesn't really have to be taught. You know, it's not a conscious decision often either. It happens before. It's like spontaneous reflex. It's like a reflexive action. It's just you only realize it's happened after the fact if you get startled by a snake. And I think there's, you know, some potential for hardwiring biologically our mind's ability to observe these things and recognize them, you know, essentially instinctually, such that eye position would be one of those things, I would think. And then feeds back into the concept of you're projecting through your eyes. And so back to the concept of the deer's projection would be a diffuse one. It would be, say, through 270 degrees. And then a predator, you know, would have 180 degree view, but very precise locked in focal point of say 20 degrees. And if you're in that 20 degree zone, the amount of signal coming at you, theoretical, obviously hypothetical, but potential signal coming at you is focused in the plane of, you know, the binocular vision, the stereoscopic vision, depth perception. Okay. It's all about the depth perception. So having someone lock in almost like a fighter jet, you know, like when you know the thing is the radar scanning you, and it's like it's scanning, then it's like beep 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 beep, it's locked on, and then your missile blows you up, that kind of a thing. So that would be my hypothetical, would be there is some differentiation between focus of this energy field or whatever through the eyes when they're looking at you and the eyes are right next to each other versus one eye never sees what the other eye sees.
I'm gonna take it further. If we're talking about the potential hypothetical field being projected, maybe you only sense when a pair of eyes is locked onto you.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, non-predators, they're only gonna see you with that one eye. They turn their head to the side and they lock onto you with that one eye. Because they're watching out for you. Yes. They're not actually looking for you, you know, they're not stalking you. They're making sure you're not stalking them.
Yes.
Well, wow. Is there something biologically built in our brain that senses I have two of these sensor fields, if we want to call it that, locked onto me. Like Bob said, it's not like I'm just being swept over. They've got a radar lock.
Yes. Like, imagine this. Imagine, let's just say, we're just talking about, is it possible at this point? We're not saying probability. Yeah. I'm talking like bats hunting. Would it be helpful for the insects to be able to sense the clicks? And I don't know. I'm just speaking out of my ass right now. I would think it would be hella important to be able to sense the clicking of the bats. Not even knowing what it is, just knowing that the bats are out there hunting if they're eating, you know, bugs or whatever. So, like some kind of a signal. So the concept is not a normal signal, not something we, you know, can not, it's not, obviously not visible light reflecting off of them. It's not, the sound they make, you know, vibrating air molecules. It's not their temperature. We can feel them. They're close to us and we know something warm is there, whatever. It's something that we don't have a name for, right? It's some sixth sense that we don't have a name for. We're just trying to say, does it make sense that there would ever be such a thing? I think that's the case we should make at this point, is what are the instances it would make sense? Is it evolutionarily advantageous, or would it just break the system? I think it would be hugely advantageous.
Yeah. Because going to the bats and the insects, we're basically talking active radar versus passive radar. The bats are using active radar, bouncing these radio waves off of what's in its environment and listening to the return. And it would absolutely make sense that the insect would benefit from having a passive radar that said, that signal that just hit me came from that direction, which means that's the direction the predator is, and I need to move away from that.
100%.
Now, would it know that it's because the radio waves are bouncing off things? So how would it know the wave that it just hit is what bounced off of something, or it's the wave that is on its way to bounce off something?
Two receptors, just like you have two ears, will give you directionality.
Two antenna. If you have
two antenna, if you have any two instances, you can now judge not only directionality, but probably essentially how close it is, meaning the strength of the signal. Will hit one side or one portion stronger than the other. But yeah, wow. you're gonna figure out a way to detect that signal biologically with two receptors at least. So, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense, the active passive metaphor. I think that's it right there. That's the way it goes. If you're gonna have a concept of an evolutionary benefit to both signal and receiver, enough to claim that this is not just woo-woo. Like, I want to make a real claim. Like, this could actually be plausible. First, can we start with, is this plausible? I think we've gone through a lot of iterations here that are beautifully distinctive of the principle behind this idea and why it's intriguing. Because the claim that we've seen every signal there is to be seen is pretty short-sighted, pun intended, obviously. You know, this is not something we can really make a hefty claim on, that we can detect everything. Makes me think of like ultraviolet and infrared, you know, how we're spectrum-philic towards visible and we're spectrum-phobic towards infrared and ultraviolet, in that we discount its existence. Go back to the movie Predator, right? How cool was it that the Predator can see you in heat?
Yeah.
He can see
your. He can see where my joints are like just worn and old.
You know? Yeah, he can see through the wall. He can't see through the cold mud, though. That was Arnold's trick. The cold mud.
Yeah, right.
But the flame. But here's the thing. Bees examine the world like flowers in an ultraviolet sense, in a beautiful patterning sense that we have no idea it's there.
Yeah, yeah.
So just to say, metaphorically speaking, is there a concept here to get behind? I think there's a strong concept in signals unaware, but also benefiting from their detection. That's the key. It's like this double-edged sword, because if you have a signal that's very aware, we would have seen it. And if you have a signal that doesn't make any difference, what does it matter?
Yeah.
But we're trying to trying to build the foundation that there is a potential for a signal to be unseen, so to speak, and then also that it's impactful in an evolutionary sense.
So it's very complicated, and what my takeaway is, and the next time Kim and I try this staring test, we're going to be naked, high, and I'm going to cover one eye, so I'm only looking one
That's
eye.
That's right.
That's it. But no, that's it. You got to do it with an eye patch.
Yeah, yeah. But I kind of appreciate maybe, you know, don't you think during the debate that Anil, his skepticism on some of these things that Rupert Sheldrake does, because of the complexity of it, because there's so many variables, I think I kind of get it, you know, the it's got to be so hard, you know, to really try to approach it from a controlled scientific, you know,
experimentally credible.
Yeah, and to really try to prove something, you know, with the intent to like, here's a conclusion we can draw based on all this evidence. It seems
like, how do you get
I'm much happier to like, right, just do the tests and talk about it and have fun. But yeah, really having the responsibility, like I, you know, good for Rupert Sheldrake. He seems like the kind of person who cares about trying to do the best job of that that he can. But yeah, what a,
and it's hard because it's, and I've got a story that'll kind of encapsulate this, but it's like, your brain is just creating a story for what your senses, for the signal that's coming in. And you're not always aware of your brain creating that story. And here's my example. So we were on a scuba dive, right? And we're going through, they call it a swim through. It's basically an underwater cave, but you can see both ends. You know, it's like a tube.
Like a tunnel.
Yeah, tunnel, basically. And I happened to just barely bump my hand on some coral, right? Well, coral's sharp as shit. And I felt it cut me, right? And so I looked down at my hand, and I'm like, oh, that's crazy. There's still a piece of coral stuck in my hand.
Wow.
But it wasn't. It was blood. But the thing is when you're underwater, the water filters all the red light out. And so at certain depth, red just doesn't exist anymore.
Wow.
So my brain told me, hey, there's a rock there because of the color. There was nothing to associate that color with blood because it wasn't red. It was more of a bluish brown. And so my brain created this story just on the fly, instantaneously. Oh, you have a piece of rock in your hand. And I had to wipe that dot of blood away to go, huh, that's not a rock, that was blood, that's just not the right color.
Yeah, wow, man. So it didn't
remember, like, you remember in the speech, didn't the guy talk about what it looks like to find a pin? You guys remember that when he's scanning?
Yeah.
And so I think the concept is like, you have an idealized image in your brain, an archetypal idea of what the pin would look like. And if it's just on the floor amongst a busy pattern on the floor or whatever, you might see that pin multiple times as you're looking back and forth. You'll just like scan right over it because you just see a piece of it. You just see a line of it. You just see a shadow of it or something. But you have no recognition of the image of the pin. But as soon as you see it, the whole thing comes into shape. And so it's just like what you're saying, the conscious observation of the thing. You might see the actual image of the thing, but until you have a moment of recognition, right? It's the recognition of what it is, fills in all the gaps.
Yeah.
And it distinguishes itself from the background.
That happens to me all the time when I'm like looking for something and I'm like, I can't find it. And Kim's like, I'm sure it's like right under your nose. And sure enough, it is.
Yeah.
And we laugh because I'm not as observant and everything.
No, but as soon as you see it, it's there. But yeah, you've seen it the whole time. As you've looked, left it right over the mustard. How many times? 6 times now. It's been right in front of you the whole time. I'm right there with you, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yeah. So, you know, what kind of comes to mind is with, again, just how complex this must be to really try to scientifically draw conclusions, and maybe the skepticalness, I suppose, of Anil, I think Anil is the one that said at some point how important it is to take people's experience seriously, but not literally. We were kind of talking about this before we started recording as well. And it really lends itself to Tanya Lerman's points. So, you know, we thought we'd maybe focus a little bit more on her take this episode because we hadn't really dived in yet. So, you know, again, Tanya Lerman is the anthropology professor, anthropology and psychology at Stanford. And most of what she had to talk about was, you know, meeting up with people and listening to their experience, primarily like religious experience. But she mentioned something I had never heard of before called, actually, before we get there, I wanted to ask about this inner homunculus, because I think she's the one that brought that up too. And this, I think this showed up in something else recently I saw, which was the timing is funny, you know, when that happens. But I had not heard of it, the homunculus. It translates from the Latin as little man, but it's always referred to our like inner human. I guess. So inner homunculus, this person maybe in our consciousness driving or whatever. But the question I wanted to ask both of you, and I'll answer it for myself too, but about hearing the voice of the inner homunculus, like do you either of you hear voices in your head that you would associate with this idea of an inner homunculus?
He sounds just like me. It's just in my head. Like I don't know. And we've talked about this before, that, you know, there was a recent discovery that a fairly large percentage of the population doesn't have that inner homunculus. And for people that do, I think that's hard to even comprehend. It's like you have a brain that doesn't like talk to you 24/7, like just rambling on and on about shit constantly. That sounds nice in some ways, but I can't imagine that.
Right.
Like there's always a voice in my head.
And I want to know what your experience is too, Bob, but I guess the other question that should be important here is like, am I making a leap to the voice piece from the inner homunculus, or is it the same thing? When people say the inner homunculus and people talk about hearing the voice, is that the same thing or is it two different things? But anyway, Bob, like what's your experience with hearing voices in your head, as it were?
Well, let me go with the second one first, because I think it's an interesting facet on it. Where I think it's more about the feeling, what it feels like to be conscious. And it feels like you're inside your head, but your brain doesn't have any sensation. Okay, not technically. I could cut your skull open and jab at your brain and you would not know. I mean, you'd probably know your head had been, you know, cranium, but there's no sensation there. But it feels like you're looking through these eyes, and the place behind the eyes is where you're looking from. Kind of feels like you're in a machine, because you could lose an arm, you could lose a leg, you're okay. It's like a machine that there's a man or woman at a control of, able to pull a lever here, push a button there, and the foot goes. Yeah. It feels like I could just ping you in your noggin and shut down your entire organization, right? I could just slip something in your drink, and now you're a whole different thing.
Yeah. Anesthesia thing. Just
yeah, the
turned
anesthesia.
Off.
I mean, we're not putting, you know, I know you could probably inject anesthesia, but, you know, we're putting it so that it can get into your brain. And if we can't get it into your brain for whatever reason, it's not going to work. You know what I mean? Like, there's a reason why we have this metaphor of this inner homunculus. I think it comes from where our hallucination models are centered at, where our hallucination, because let me go back to this. Out of body experience, literal out of body experience, meaning dissociative nature of a chemical, can make you feel like you're floating above yourself, looking down upon yourself on the surgery table and the surgeons and nurses taking care of you and all this other stuff. Or, you know, maybe you have a terrible accident and you fall and you hit your head and you float up from the bathtub and you go, you know, floating through the rooms of your house or something, looking for help. I mean, there's all these different concepts of, let's say, psychedelics, okay? And your model is now uncontrollable. It's not even like a function of you're floating up. It's just everything is dissolving from what would normally be a real representation or a simulation of reality. Now it's tied to nothing. It's free floating. It's just an amalgam of intrusive dreamlike experiences that are uncontrollable to your inner homunculus. So the concept I think here that's of interest is it feels like the center of our existence is inside this little piece of our biology. And I think it's indicative of this is, you know, a very large portion of our cognition is inside our brain. And so it's trying to represent or model something that's maybe intuitive. You know, it's like a concept that you could share with others at an intuitive level without any evidence. And there's no evidence here. Nobody, you know, until just maybe 100 years ago, really understood how hardly anything in biology worked, right? Hardly anything. So this is a recent line of inquiry, really dialing in, peeling the layers of the onion apart to try to figure out it. We have functional MRIs now, you know, that are used to decide what parts of the brain are active, not just is it your brain, but what parts of your brain are active at any given time, and how active are they, and how interconnected are they, and how does it happen when someone has an injury or, you know, some sort of biological defect that they're dealing with? How does that shed light on what is actually happening? All these things that are, you know, interesting examples that we're pulling upon are all peeling the layers off the onion here to figure out what is it really happening. And I think it's such an interesting, Anil, going back to him real quick, making it as a concept of a hallucination.
Yeah.
Because once you let go that what we experience, your subjective experience, once you let go that is tied to reality, so much locks into place. So much becomes a predictive model that makes sense. You know, losing the reality of the thing allows you to explain so much more than trying to reconcile, you know, what happens when reality doesn't feel very real anymore or whatever.
Interesting.
You know, I don't even know how or where this is going to go, but it's you know, okay, so the people without that inner homunculus, are they just existing as a biological entity because of the brain, right? But are there senses that we have that we're not aware of where those of us with that inner voice are tuning into one additional channel that we can converse with?
Real quick,
inside of our brain.
I don't think that there is much validity to the claim of not having an inner monologue, not having. It's essentially just saying, like, I don't have to breathe oxygen and expel carbon dioxide. It's like, yeah, right. I just don't.
Yeah, part of me agrees. Like, I haven't looked into this study more to see how they came up with that conclusion. And maybe that's something we should do some homework on. But then I would also go, okay, so the people that she was talking about who are having these conversations with something that is beyond them,
they're conversing with
something that's not their own voice in their head. Is that an additional channel?
No, then you
have schizophrenics who have multiple personalities, and are they just tuned into more channels than they're capable of deciphering, and one just comes through stronger at any given time? I'm not saying I believe this. I'm just throwing it
the extra channel, I think, is more likely than no channel. And here's what I would claim the answer is for why did the survey find that answer profile. And I'm going to say it's the amount of modern humans, especially young ones, who grow up with a smart device in their hand so frequently that their attention because when, let's say you're watching a video, or let's say you have an infinite scroll of videos. Essentially, you're just flicking your finger, and your attention is captivated for hours. And so I think what ends up happening is many people can be lulled into a sense of passive radar, let's just call it. And they're not really actively projecting anything out into the system. And so their survey response would be, no, I'm just aware of things, but not a monologue of things. I don't have an abstraction layer of maybe I should do this, maybe I should do that, or you know, this concept of inner homunculus. Maybe it's they're not aware of a process of debate internally. They're just kind of floating through experience and, you know, distracting themselves in the meantime. I could see that as a realistic percentage, 10%, 15% of the population that would be, you know, filling out the survey like that, as opposed to somebody like yourself or say somebody who is actively trying to write a poem. Like, how laughable would it be for anybody, any poet who's ever written a poem, to think that there is no inner monologue? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It's like saying, you know, water is not wet. It's like, just, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, there's a compositional component of dialogue, especially when you're writing it down in a, say like a haiku, where it has to be conceived internally before you can write it down. I don't think anybody is saying that someone could just start, you know, what do they call it when you just scribble stuff without thinking about whatever that's
pre-association?
Something like that. Yeah. I don't think anybody's going to think you're going to get War and Peace out of that.
Well, think about this too. And it ties back into the whole staring thing. Anything you do with your brain is a skill that can be trained and developed, right? So there is literally no point in human history better than today for that staring trait to have gone away. You know, we haven't been preyed on for several thousand years, really. I mean, we've kind of mastered nature in a way that getting killed by an animal is not something most of us even consider in our day-to-day life. So that skill would atrophy away. Well, the same thing could be happening with the infinite scroll stuff today, where it's like you so focused on just consuming content all the time that skill of having that debate with your inner monologue at all times has atrophied.
That's what I'm saying.
You're having people just... there's no need for them to create in their own head.
That's right. I think it's like trying to deal with having a detailed conversation with someone with a very small vocabulary. Like, you have to have a vocabulary in order to exchange these ideas.
Oh, bigly.
I
think I could take the other side of that. Like, have to. Helpful for sure. I don't know, have to, like, I think there is still the possibility of communicating with low vocabulary, because it's about, like, because at the root of it is the feelings, right? The experiences.
Let me just talk right to this point. I would say it's akin to addition. You can accomplish the same as multiplication with addition. It just takes a lot longer.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So, it's much more helpful to have.
But if you don't have multiplication, if you don't have multiplication, you can't do exponents. Like, you're missing out on whole topics of ideas. Like, once you can't even understand what an exponent is, because it's multiplying something by itself a certain number of times. Like, I think your point is right. You can take a long time. You could build a pyramid with hand tools and stuff like that. You could definitely do that. But I think there becomes a deficit, a noticeable deficit, when your hand tools aren't even hand tools anymore. You're just trying to do it by hand.
Yeah. Maybe a question of efficiency, I guess, at the end of the day.
Well, but not always. That's what I'm saying. Like, you could lose out on the concept of exponents because you can't even conceive of multiplication. So their exponents are meaningless in an additive sense. I mean, you could add something that would achieve the same thing as, you know, a number to the third power, obviously, but that's not the point. I'm talking about the conceptual level, being able to notate something like the cube of something, right? Like, you're losing out on that if you can only add numbers together.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So I want to, I'll share what my experiences with the voices in my head is, and curious if this is relatable or what will come of this. But for me, like, kind of like you said, Tucker, I mean, I hear my own voice, but I hear other people's voices in my head too. Like, the thing that I have to, you know, kind of be careful of is when these conversations are happening in my head, if they steer towards things that are like making me frustrated or angry, generally I've just recognized like, that's not helpful. I really try to like stop that. But the point is like, I can hear my own voice. I hear like a monologue, but invariably, I will hear Kim's voice, you know, contradicting me or like, you know, saying the thing that I just feel very strongly like she would say anyway, if we were having the conversation out loud. And it's very interesting to me because I'm hearing that as if it was happening out in the real world, but it's not, it's all in my head. So it's not really her voice. It's all my voice, but I hear it. I hear the things that she would say. I feel very strongly about that because we've been together for so long, and I feel very confident that like most of the time whatever my subconscious is like throwing at me in my inner monologue that's become a dialogue now or whatever, that there's a lot of accuracy in the things that Kim is saying in my head. And you know, then dialogue becomes like a group conversation. I hear you guys in my head sometimes, the things that you would say as my consciousness train is just running away with the thoughts that are really cool and interesting to me. I hear you guys. I hear your voices saying, "What about this, though?" You know. So, I don't, is that relatable? Like, how does that tie into all this?
Dude, I had more arguments with my wife inside my own head than we have ever had in real life, like by light years. And I think the interesting takeaway from that is I think it's your brain's way of trying to see the situation from that other person's perspective. And we don't always do that rationally because we're not that other person.
Yeah.
I think we're probably generally much harder on ourselves in our head when our head is creating that other person than that other person actually is in real life. But there's something about human nature that we find it difficult to just sit down and actually have that conversation with that person rather than just spending 6 days having that conversation with that imaginary person in your head. Like, it's always much easier once you sit down and just talk about it, and it takes half an hour of your day and then it resolves that. But there's something about the creative mind that's just like, no, why resolve it when I can spend countless hours creating this story for you?
Yeah. I would say, because you said it's like always easier to just actually do it. I don't know about you, because I'm picky with words. I don't know that I'd say always easier. In fact, many times I think sometimes it is easier to not have the conversation in real life. I would say it's probably more often than not, it's more helpful in the long run to actually have the conversation in real life. But yeah, like, cause I feel that tendency a lot of times. It makes me think of Dumbledore saying to Harry and Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And I don't remember if this quote is a movieism or if it's actually in the book, but he says, you know, pretty soon there'll come a time when you have to decide between what is right and what is easy. And I recognize that a lot. A lot of times my brain's just doing something and I'm recognizing it's just doing that because it's the easy thing.
Well, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's not necessarily a question of like, if it's easy or hard. It's like, well, what's the right thing to do? Like, maybe the right thing is to you know, put the easy thing aside and actually have the conversation out loud. And maybe that happens to be a hard thing to also, but yeah, I just think more often than not, it's much more helpful, you know, cause again, like the things in my head, you know, that's only my head. Like I think the effort is profound and helpful. Like you said, Tucker, to, it's our consciousness trying to appreciate what the perspective must be for somebody else. You know, I do think that's the gateway to empathy, right? Like that's so helpful.
Let me talk to that for a second. It's a very interesting facet of the conversation. Let me introduce a metaphor of an LLM, of a way to draw upon previous experiences, meaning when you ask an LLM a question, it's going to give you an answer that it does not understand. Okay, there's no thinking going on. It's doing math. It's multiplying matrices. It's giving you probabilities of what each token, likely the next token in line, will be. Repeating this process in order to come up with some simulation of a, you know, a reasoned response. And my point is, it's pulling upon a training set of data. And if your wife is in your training set, and your parents and your coworkers and your children and your brothers and sisters and your community, and that's what you're going to hear. That's what comes in. That's what you experience in your subjective interior monologue and how it feels. Okay, it's going to be this answer and response system where you're pondering something. What should I do about this? What? And that's when grandma's voice comes in, starts whispering in your ear. This is what you do, child. And it's something she said many times. It's not something that you just made up and put her voice on. It's coming from the training data. It's coming from whatever it is that you came from. And so there's this point at which you have to differentiate between using the stored knowledge, in which case correlation does not matter. It doesn't matter if anybody has a causative understanding why she's saying this. There's a corollary, you know, if you do this, then this will happen, sense to it. And then the other side is having to really understand what is happening in a causation sense. Those are two different things. And I think that's where we shift back and forth, meaning we're not consciously coming up with grandma's whispered words of wisdom. Those are intrusive. Those are coming in to help guide us in the moment because you typed into the chatbot, oh, chatbot, what should I do now? You know?
Yeah.
And this thing comes to you. Your guardian angel, whatever this thing is that you're observing or sensing comes to you. And then that's different when you are, you know, trying to figure out something that's new. Okay, you've got no cliche that applies. You've got no store of metaphors that are analogous. It's not like anything else. It's not anything you've seen before. That's when the consciousness is at play and you are now in control. You are driving for once. you subjectively, you are now, your attention is guiding the ship. And so paying attention is very powerful. And it comes into free will a little bit and responsibility. So getting into, you know, if this is a humanistic state of being that we're not really coming up with our own ideas all the time, maybe then we're not responsible for our actions.
Yeah.
So this is that Zapolsky argument.
Right.
People are deterministic. They are forced by their inner homunculus to feel a certain way to go. Like if you had a branding iron behind you and I stuck it on your back, you're going to move forward. Right? Like I will bet money if I put a branding iron against your back, you're going to move forward. I would bet the house on it. So how, you know, if a series of branding iron events, it's turtles all the way down or whatever you want to call it, tumors all the way down, whatever. Like you could kind of go that way. And I'm saying for a portion is correct. Portion is correct. You are not coming up with grandma's voice in your ear. She is intrusive. she's being answered to the question of what do I do now? But you didn't know what was going to come out.
Yeah.
That's your subconscious. Your subconscious answering you is, you know, its own little thing.
So I think there's.
Think of it like this way, like, and this to me could be why we will never have a true AI, right? A LLM is basing its decision off of already established models. It's a what was machine. It bases its whole outlook on what was and what has already happened and basing its predictive model off of that. Whereas the human brain, if we want to look at it as it's starting to be thought of as a quantum computer, is a what is and what could be machine. Like, we're basing our decisions off of events we're creating in our own head on what could happen. And basing our decision off of boiling down all those probabilities of what could happen to what I think is going to happen. I don't know that we'll ever create a machine that is going to be able to do what we do at our level.
Yeah. I think I can tie all this together with and then end with a question that I'm pretty sure the moderator maybe brought up or something, but so if we're talking about like this, you know, subconscious intrusive thought thing, it's coming from a, you know, something that, you know, is real for your own experience. Like, your subconscious is basing this off of something that happened. And so to go back to this, the conversations, dialogues we have in our head with ourselves, but, you know, with other voices or whatever. I want to bring up, Tucker, you mentioned this, but I think it was before we started recording, so I hope you don't mind if I paraphrase the point you were making about this old adage about there's two sides to every story. And you said, you know, you didn't really like that because there's three sides. You know, there's the first story of the one person who saw it, the second story is the other person who saw it, but the third story is what actually happened, the actual truth of the moment of whatever it happened, you know, because we're just observing, you know, each person is limited by their own observation. So the actual truth is there. And so this question comes up, and again, I don't remember if the moderator specifically asked it. I don't think he may have mentioned it in the opening, because I don't think they talked about it specifically, but I wrote it down because I'm really interested here. Because the question is there a difference between things that are true and things that are important? So real quick, to go back to grandma's, you know, advice. You're hearing, you know, I'm hearing my grandma's, you know, my inner LLM is giving me grandma's advice. It's important advice, you know, because it happens to be about something, and maybe it's like power and responsibility, and it's very important. But is it true? Like, did she say it to me just now? In reality, no. It's, you know, if I could just kind of snap my fingers and relive the moment, but have grandma right there, would she say the exact same thing that my head told me she said? Right? Probably not. So where does the importance between truth and what's the difference between things that are true and things that are important?
This is a great parsing of the concept. The LLM is working from a corollary sense. So it is just taking something that it knows happens at one point, and then high probability it knows what comes next. But there's no understanding here. It's literal just mathematics. It's literal abstract probabilities that are being calculated and then tabulated. And then there's some kind of a heat map, so they don't always pick the most likely. They want to pepper in some interesting stuff, so maybe they, you know, the third most likely answer every time. I don't know. But there's not any understanding about what is being said. It's just a response. So I'm saying the subconscious, the unconscious, has no understanding in a deductive reasoning sense. There's no understanding of causation here in principle. being able to say, okay, I can abstract, you know, this ball, if I hit the cue ball, one ball into the next ball, you know, the next ball starts moving. Well, I could play that a million times in my head and get the patterns just right. But that's never going to crack the nut of F equals MA and being able to formulate an abstraction that covers that real instance. That's understanding. Okay, that is something that isn't grandma's voice. It's a different instance. It's trying to uncover why, when I hit this ball, take the cue ball on an eight ball. Why is it when I hit the cue ball into the eight ball and it connects squarely, does the cue ball stop and the eight ball keep moving or start to move? Excuse me. Why isn't the cue ball, like, assuming no spin, why isn't the cue ball only transfer 75%? And then it goes 25% of the end. You know, like, why do these things happen? It's trying to figure this stuff out is a conscious process. Having your inner LLM give you an answer you should have known is unconscious. It's just a probabilistic. And I don't even think that the unconscious brain knows the words, meaning it's in grandma's voice. It knows this is what she would say in this instance. But it's speaking as if, I like this example. There's a Scrabble grandmaster in the US who went to France, learned their Scrabble dictionary, doesn't know what any of the words mean, and he would win because the competition was so much lower in France just because there's fewer people and they don't take it as seriously. And he just cleaned house, didn't speak a lick of French, didn't know what any of the words meant.
But just knew the words, knew the letter combinations.
Correct. He was just really good at playing the game of Scrabble. Understanding the game of Scrabble has nothing to do with the meanings of the words. It just is. It's just not tied together. Yeah. So go back to this other thing about what Tucker was saying about the computer will not be able to come up with the next thing. And I think that's the focal point, meaning it's the nonsensical proposition that the computer cannot envision. We have to, meaning humans, have to have this creative side, this concept of God, let's just say an abstraction here, of concept of something that's unprovable. Okay, it's not even just... it's like your love for your family or whatever. You can't show me where it exists, but you know it does, right? Like this goes back to contact. Show me prove that you love your father. Yeah, prove it.
Yeah.
So I'm saying there are things in your condition that are not on the provable sense. Anyway, going back to that concept of, you know, truth and importance. I think that's where you should be struggling with the tension between knowing something from repetition, which you should trust. It's probably right. The probability is on its side that little whisper in your ear is going to be right, from understanding why is it right. Okay. The consciousness should be trying to figure out, why is that voice correct? Why is grandma's voice in my ear right now? What is this saying that she always says, come hell or high water? Why does that mean something to me now? Understanding that is the consciousness.
Yeah, it's like the Oracle says in Matrix Reloaded, you didn't come here to make the choice, you've already made it. You came here to understand why you made the choice.
That's exactly it. 100%. That's it.
Well, and I would say that even you could look at it a different way and say that the truth only exists as a function of time. The truth is only true about an event that has already happened, because you could theoretically, you could say there's no laser base on the moon, and that's true, but that may not always be true.
And I
think that's the difference between biology and computing, is that we have a way to go, this doesn't exist, but I could make it exist. If I think about it long enough, I can create something that has never before in the universe existed. Whereas a computer just cares about what already exists. That's all it knows. Has no concept of now, creating things.
There is an introduction of a new concept in computing. It's synthetic training data. So there is this concept that they can synthesize the training data. And then there's also a concept of adversarial networks. So they create multiple iterations of an AI that kind of plays the game against another AI. And with those two things, you can kind of get quasi-creativity. I wouldn't count it out, is what I'm saying. I wouldn't say it's 100% impossible for artificial intelligence to become not just a mimic, but a true creator. I would hold off on judgment of that just yet. I think you're correct in that today it's not comparable. But I think in the future, I'd be careful with that statement. Just like you're saying, in the future that we might have a laser base on the moon. You're right. I'd be careful.
Well, yeah, and it could be with far in the future,
you know? And it could be that quantum computing is what's going to do that, because it goes back to, you know, how computers work. It's either a one or a zero. Well, once that computer has the ability to go, could it be both? And that's kind of what they're trying to do with quantum computing, in the very little that I actually understand it, but that may be the breakthrough that makes me eat those words.
Do we think this is possible in our lifetime?
I don't rule out much anything in the span of a lifetime. When you figure we went from the first powered human flight to the moon in what, under 100 years?
Yeah.
60 years.
60.
Right.
Yeah. And especially because technology is exponential, and that the things that come are built off of all these other things that made it possible. And as this tree expands, it's going to make that much more possible that we never thought was.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, you look at the climate science and the whole climate debate and where we could be headed. And a lot of it looks catastrophic, and the water wars, but you can't figure in the technology that we could possibly develop before the end. I mean, we develop a functional fusion reactor. Guess what? That makes desalinization much more feasible. And the reason we're not desalinating for fresh water now is the enormous energy requirements. Well, when you basically have limitless energy, turn all the oceans into drinking water. I mean, not all of them.
You could actively pull
as much as we can, but
you could actively do a lot of stuff. I think that's the way to look at it, is a series of unpredictable, but light year jumps ahead. You know, things that stutter, start and stop. It's not a clean linear progression of progress. It's these massive game changers, you know, massive discoveries, like, you know, going from Newtonian physics to relativity and stuff like that, you know. You can't really account for when it happens. You just know over the arc of history, you know, these things probably do happen. So I think that's a good way to look at it, is it's really unpredictable, but it's probably like two geniuses away. I mean, just like call like an Einstein scalar. How many Einsteins does it take?
Yeah. to get you? How many Einsteins?
It probably takes like two, I would say two, you know, I don't know. But another thing would be, it could already be, the answer could be here already. It could be multiple answers, doesn't have to be one, but you know, there's a part of the network effect that should be kicking in soon, I think. When you start connecting everybody, my point would be like, how many Einsteins have come and gone in silence? You're right. How many geniuses stayed in the cave and didn't come out to tell what they, you know, what they saw? So there is that, where these things could be happening all the time. But one, the human population was so low, it was not as impactful as, you know, this is the upside. This is like the concept of having more and more humans race to get to the next genius person to unlock fusion. And that will pay for all the rest, right? That will give us what we need to protect our planet, not trying to limit population to 500 million and live in a Garden of Eden, but go for 50 billion, you know, find your 15 Einsteins and, you know, unlock the wormhole.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, think of it this way. Like, you look at, let's look at, like, naval development. It was a fairly linear progression from the earliest wood ships that they threw cannons on up through the battleships of World War II. You know, they got bigger, they got better armored, and they got bigger guns. Well, why don't we have battleships today? Because we develop missile technology. And you don't need a 16-inch cannon on a battleship. You just need missile pods. Because they can reach hundreds of miles as opposed to tens of miles. And that one development made everything else obsolete.
Yeah.
You know, the guns that are on modern day naval ships are small guns meant for small craft that are approaching. Any of the bigger stuff, I mean, they're firing at stuff they can't even see. You know, it's over the horizon.
It's, yeah, guided, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's being, it's being guided by an AWACS airplane up in the sky that has a lock on it. Like, the ship it's firing at is so far over the horizon, there's no straight line sensor for them to even see it.
That's there's a really great depiction of that in the latest Mission Impossible movie, except it's a submarine, but it's the same kind of thing. Like, it's not about aiming the submarine at the thing so that the torpedo, because the torpedo is like guided, so it just has to get out into the water, and it's it looks great. It just like dumps it out in the water, and then it takes off going in like the direction it needs to go. It's like pretty fascinating. I'm trying to think of how to like bring this back into the other Tonya Lerman thing I wanted to bring up.
Tuppermancy thing. I think that's
Interesting. So I was going to say, So that's the next, that's another flavor of this idea about the dialogue in your head, the inner homunculus. I don't want to say the next level because I don't think it's helpful to talk about it in terms of levels, but it's certainly another flavor of it, that this idea of tulpomancy, which is a new term to me, and it's creating and conversing with an invisible other, and sounded a lot like imaginary friend to me. I don't think Tonya used that term, but she did say that the way she said, I think there's a corner of the internet where this is a thing that is like 30,000 some unique usernames of people that that do this thing and create a tulpa, this being, this other being that they converse with out loud, you know. So it's, again, I think it's relatable to the inner homunculus, except it's not all imagined inside, it's imagined outside. Well,
we've already covered, I think, the take home, which is it's grandma's voice.
So the tulpomancy would be you'd actually imagine grandma there, and you'd be speaking out loud. You know, that's the difference.
Well, what I'm saying is you're creating the new grandma. You actually had a grandma, or you have, or whatever. And what I'm saying, this is a way to create that future grandma's voice, making it real. The interaction between this avatar creature, whatever it is, the powers, the characteristics, you will program it. You're going to train your LLM with this data so that in the future it will converse with you in this regard. This goes back to contact, when the aliens scan the brain of Ellie to figure out how to communicate with her. So imagine you know that if you have a chorus of voices, not an overwhelming chorus, not an intrusive one against your will, but let's say each voice is very helpful. And if they sing to you, good things happen. Okay. Why not figure out why? Let's say in the past it was because humans all lived within a mile from where they were born, and they had a strong tie to their family. And, you know, you had 200 of these voices in your head through your lifetime. Well, maybe modern people, they're down to two of them. I'm just making these up, obviously, but whatever. Like, maybe this is a modern adaptation to input into your LLM, the training set, the data of what you expect to get out in the future. You know, whether you don't have to even know how it works, by the way, it doesn't matter if you know. It's like being, it's like Pavlovian. It's just this conditioning. Okay. You can condition your own mind, self-hypnosis, self-delusion, self, what did Anil call it? It's a hallucination. Self-hallucination is what you're really trying to do. You're trying to embed a hallucination into your hallucination generator that will speak to you at a future time or keep you company. Like what Tucker said, you're going to have 250 conversations about the one that you have in real life. You'll have 250 times or whatever, paraphrasing. You will have this conversation about this thing you're going to talk about with your wife or your boss or somebody. And you'll have one actual real one, if that. Maybe you won't. Maybe you choose not to have the conversation. But my point is, the power lies in the model, the ability for your LLM to play through scenarios, give you predictions. That's the interplay that sharpens the knife.
Mm-hmm. So is that something either of you have experience with, like in your lifetime, kind of imaginary friends or?
No, not really. And, you know, my whole knee-jerk reaction to some of her stuff talking about people conversing with these beings outside of themselves is Ben Affleck's character from the Jay and Silent Bob movie trying to explain to Jay and Silent Bob they're fictional characters, you know? And that's exactly what we do in our brain when we're having these discussions with our loved ones, is we're creating a fictional loved one. It's not the real person. It's our interpretation of what that person would say based on our own experiences and, most importantly, our own biases. And to me, I'm always going to lean more towards, you created a fictional deity in your head based on your own set of beliefs. And then that fictional deity is telling you what you already believe because you created that.
Yeah. Do you think it's also an opportunity, or could be an opportunity, for kind of the opposite, for having someone there to give the contradicting opinions and give the, you know, challenging, positions to help yourself question your biases, things.
That's exactly it. That's what you want, because when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Yep.
If you have one God that always speaks one message, one way, that's what you're going to get. But the concept of having, this is back to the anthropologist, understanding many different versions of many cultures' metaphors, theoretically, then your LLM will come up with the right one at the right time. That's what you want. You just want it to be a metaphor, a symbol of a concept, an idea that you can draw upon. It goes back to the discussion of vocabulary, I'm afraid. The more vocabulary you have, the more richly you can describe a thing, the more powerfully, the more compressed it can be. And so
that's why they shouldn't send poets.
Correct, exactly. Yeah. It's 100% it. That's it. Totally. Root cause is you got to send a poet first. Otherwise, your mathematician will just write an equation and nobody will give a shit. You know? No, I think that's perfect, though.
I think it's even biologically, what's the word I'm looking for? Beneficial to have the type of brain that has these, not, I speak to this fictional character and it tells me what to do. Okay, that's great. It gives you a framework to live your life. But if you're the type of person who has heated debates with your fictional characters and creates all these what ifs and the scenarios, you're basically training your brain to have an answer to more scenarios it could possibly be put in real life. If you've already created it in your head and had that argument and had that discussion and have an answer to that situation before it happens, you don't have to think about it. You just react to it.
It's like the holodeck. You know, it's like being able to take Einstein and put him in, you know, 1990s, you know, the Matrix movie or something. Like being able to take a concept from one area and one environment and take it out of its context, put it into a new place, and then synthesize. What would happen if Tom Clancy wrote, you know, a podcast script for, you know, children who are handicapped? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out. Like, you could just take something, right? You just take something and put it somewhere else. I think there is power there in trying to find out what, right? What would the voice be of somebody who has this lived experience, this kind of cliche about them, and then juxtaposing them with the Wild Wild West or whatever, and just see what happens.
Yeah, there's a really, really beautiful kind of example of that, I think, in the movie 3,000 Years of Longing. I believe I've told you guys about that once or twice. amazing movie. Highly recommend it. And it really fits with this topomancy idea, because the main character, there's like a backstory of having an imaginary friend. And the main part of the story of the movie is this genie. It's like a genie out of a bottle kind of story, but it's really well done. But specifically with, you said Einstein, you said like moving, there's a scene where Einstein's on a television. It's just like a video of Einstein like speaking or whatever. And the genie like pulls Einstein out of the TV, and he's holding this tiny Einstein, and he's like, I can expand him if you want to talk to him. And she's like, no, put him back. I thought that was, I wanted to mention that. The other reference that comes to mind with I guess more of the inner dialogue thing, but the book, it's called Conversations with God. I think I've told you guys about that as well. The title might be a little misleading, but it's this guy, Neil Donald Walsh, who just kind of was at a low, very low point in his life and just ended up just like writing out questions like, why is my life not going the way I wanted it to? And for 15 minutes, he was just writing, and then he stopped writing, but he found he couldn't put the pen down. And within a few minutes, like the answers started coming to him in his head. And so the book is these conversations he's had with this voice, which he does say it's God. The audiobook is great because there's two narrators, Ed Asner and I can't remember her name, but it's a female actor, an older lady. I'm gonna have to like look it up. So, but anyway, it's a really cool experience because you're not hearing just one voice of God. And you know, I don't really know what I believe God wise, but I think I'm much more inclined to believe that it's not just a single thing or entity, and certainly maybe not a man. It's just a man. Like that seems like less likely to me than it's if there is a single God. It's, I don't know, some kind of
Alanis Morissette.
Yeah. Or just something that we just like, I suppose I'm just like saying what I want to believe about it, but that it's something that we just can't really comprehend. You know what I mean? The idea that it's like a man seems kind of too easy or unlikely, I guess, for me.
I've always found it kind of egotistical that, you know, ask a person to envision something that can create a planet and they'll go, I don't know. But you have this perfect vision of a being that created the whole universe. It's like, we don't seem to have any issue with that huge jump in scale, like as a species, you know, we seem very comfortable. Oh yeah, I know God. I know what he's like.
I think the cosmology of the monotheists had Earth at the center of the universe.
It did. And the Catholic Church did not amend that stance until the 1970s.
Yeah, which is just craziness to really, like, wow. That whole time, they were just like, no.
But let me
on the priority list, I guess. And by the way, it was Ellen Burstyn was the actress's name. I just wanted to throw that out there. Anyway,
well, let me flip it around real quick, though, and look at it from another point of view, in that hard to believe, ironically, the thing that refuted the true cosmology, let's just call it, the thing that refuted the cosmological progress was exactly what was needed to give societal stability to allow for eventual progress.
Say that one more time. Wait, can you run through that one more time?
So the irony is, let's just say the Abrahamic religions, let's just say the irony might be that the cosmology created, or the timing of the creation of these concepts, the culture of these religions, was human-centric, meaning we couldn't conceive of not being the center of the universe. But even though they were suppressive of countercultural ideas vis-a-vis Galileo, Copernicus, let's just say, in the long run, the stability societally provided by these Abrahamic religions and the culture that came with them is exactly what unlocked the keys to the scientific exploration and eventual discovery of our true place, or seemingly true place, cosmologically speaking.
Yeah, I mean, I will always give religion the credit it's due, because it turned us from tribes into towns, into cities, into city-states and nations. I mean, it really a unifying factor.
Yeah, unifying, yeah.
But it's funny to me, like, if we look at Catholicism or Christianity in general, it was this huge unifying force. But then at some point, they lost control of it, and you went from basically having the Catholic Church, which controlled Christianity as a whole, to where we are today, where there's 30,000 denominations of Christianity around the world that don't agree with each other on what it means to be a Christian and how to be a Christian. And so it was almost like once that scientific explosion happened and they lost control of the narrative, it fractured back into tribes.
Well, hold on. Let's take this. Don't go back to tribes, but go back to what we've been talking about, the Tupamancy. So is religion not just creating this imaginary friend, but most of the people that you know have the same tuppy? You know, you're like sharing your Tupamancy because you're all agreeing upon the same tuppa.
And yeah, so, there's an L in there, tulpa.
Thank you, tulpa. I knew I mispronounced that. Thank you, John. Tulpa.
Sure.
So you have this sense of shared tulpa-ness that is comforting, and it's a like a social lubricant. It's a shibboleth. You know, you can tell in-group from out-group. It gives you metaphorical compression and encryption of data. I mean, there's just so many functional benefits. The only downside, honestly, is not knowing it's happening. Literal belief in the thing is what causes the train to go off the rails occasionally, because I can make a tulpa that is equally valid compared to somebody else's tulpa, but maybe mine, you know, the rules of the game are you have to give me 10% of everything you own, and
right,
you got to wash my car on the weekends, all this stuff, you know, like it could be abused. This concept of this shared metaphor can be abused, but it's also a gift in that it gives us the ability to communicate with our network and to be productive and to stabilize, you know, like we can create a history. Let's just say out of all the things perhaps beneficial of the Abrahamic religions was just the history of it, just writing things down. The ability to have a narrative written down in an abstraction and pointed to, I'm showing you this book. It is true. It is written there. I mean, I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent. I'm saying just any oral tradition against that is going to lose. Like, I've got this book. It shows right here. And I have 50 other people have the copy of the same book. And we could all turn to page 43 right now and read the same words. And I could take it home tonight. And I can memorize it. And I can give it to my kids. And they can memorize it. You know, like, it's just so powerful. Just the tech coinciding with the content of the culture, meaning the power of abstracting and writing things down is undeniable. So going back to the tech. So these people who created the church, they wanted supremacy. They wanted control, maybe unconsciously, subconsciously. They wanted the power of the priesthood. So they don't want to change the book. They want it to stay the way it is. Okay. So you get the tension between the power of the tech and those people who have an entrenched outcome based on status quo. They don't want to shift. They don't want to change. They don't want a revolution. They got a second house. Right. They're not looking for a revolution, my brother. Okay. So we have this tension of the ability of the tech to allow for accumulation of wealth and to have comfort and prosperity, security, entertainment, all this stuff. But yet, how are we going to proceed if everybody's holding on to what they got? No one's letting go. No,
yeah.
It's got to change. We are changing. So going back to this democratization of ideas, meaning it goes from one pope to 30,000 little popettes, you know, one tulpa to everybody is their individualized tulpamancer. And they now can create and program their own inner monologue and their own abstraction of a deity, etc., and their avatar of their choosing. But I think it's instrumental to understand the process where there's, why are these things happening the way they are? Not just that this follows that, right?
Yeah.
This is why it makes sense to understand the tulpa.
Well, that ties in with one of the things I think Tanya says in her opening remarks, that she says that her work shows that the more that people imagine the boundary between thoughts and the world as permeable, the more likely they are to hear, feel, or see the presence of a God or spirit. So like you just said, Bob, like, what, you know, why are these things happening? So that's interesting to me, this, the idea about the boundary between thoughts and the world. We, you know, danced around this the whole episode so far, like what's going on inside our head versus what's actually happening in the outside our heads. And so this, you know, the point she's making is that, in her work and her studies, research, and by the way, you know, if I didn't say it already, like much of her study is, you know, in the field, whatever field research, right? She's traveled all over the world and spoken, you know, face to face with these people. It's not that she's just sitting behind a computer or whatever. Like that's what I gathered is her kind of work is actually, you know, having these conversations with people. So the idea that the boundary between what's in our head and what's outside our head, what she's saying is, her conclusions that she's drawing is that the more likely somebody views that boundary as permeable, as not just a brick wall, but something with holes where things can go in and out.
I love the
fishing net. Oh, yeah, yeah, fishing net. Yeah, yeah.
Let the big fish get caught,
the more likely
little fish swim through, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And so the more likely a person is to think of things that way, the more likely they are to hear, feel, or see the presence of a God or a spirit. So,
well, and this kind of occurred to me when we were talking about religions, but, you know, I think what a big thing that happened with religions is, you know, back in the day when the Catholic Church was basically Christianity, all the masses were in Latin. And the Bible was in Latin, and you basically had the Catholic Church and their priests and bishops and the Pope telling the masses, this is who God is, this is what he says, and this is what you believe as a Christian. They had the monopoly on that. Well, what happened to that? The printing press did. And once that Bible was translated into languages where people could take that home and read it for themselves, they created their own God. It was no longer the church telling people this is who God is. Well, now they read the book and they create that, we'll just say, fictional character in their head of what they think God is. And the same things happened with the internet. You know, we used to have institutions that controlled the knowledge. And I'm not saying that to be conspiratorial or nefarious, but it's like, you know, you got your information from these specific sources and they got it from their specific sources. And there was a hierarchy to it. When the internet was created, it was like, here you go, humanity.
Yeah,
here's all of it.
Yeah.
And everybody splintered off. It was something designed to bring us all together, but in a lot of ways, it's created 8 billion separate individuals who are all taking in the pieces of information they want and creating their own worldview. It's we don't have that unified worldview that we had 30 years ago because we're controlling the information we're taking in to a higher degree than probably the past. And we're taking in much more of it consistently.
Yeah. And it's like two way. Can I say this real quick? It's two way, right? It's not just the internet and the information is there. So now people are doing like their own individual things. I think, you know, you could argue, well, people without the internet were doing this. They're doing their own individual things already anyway. One of the other, the two-way thing, the other way is that now we're aware. We're aware that all these people on the other side of the planet have been doing, you know, these individual things that are different from our own. Do you know what I mean? Like I like to think of it that way, that it's this like cycle. It's not just a one way thing of, I'm getting this information now that didn't have access to. I can put out this information now that other people weren't aware of as well,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And there used to be more of a filter, I think, whereas you have some, let's just say, conspiracy theorist with some crazy idea and they write a book about it. Well, in the day they'd have to find somebody willing to edit it, willing to publish it, willing to get it on bookshelves.
Yep.
And they may have found that person, but how much reach did that person willing to publish that kind of stuff have? Not a whole lot. So the book's out there, but it's not in front of many eyes. Well, now that same crazy person can just bypass all that filter and get that idea out in front of a million eyes in an hour.
Yeah. In multiple formats. Cause social media, it's built in, just here's my rambling or whatever, but like Kindle Direct Publishing, you know, you can have it printed in a book. You don't need a publisher, you know, I mean, you still have to find your audience. There's still a lot to be said about that. Just because we put 100 of our haikus out on Kindle, we're not raking in money. Like we're not doing any money to like promote it. Yeah, you did. I think I got 70 cents from that. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Hey, let me jump off the book bandwagon here. Jump back to the concept of the Bible. I think this is the.
That's a book.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Jump from book to book. But the concept of the Bible being the metaphor, meaning a piece of technology going back to a ceremony in a language that the audience didn't understand. Okay. They were literally just watching a show, you know, and they were humbled by the experience, let's just say. And so they followed along. But it changes when the book comes out in a digestible format. And it changes again when the book can be edited or created or new books can be written, like the Book of Mormon or something like that, or some new offshoot, Scientology or whatever. And then once again, algorithmically, creativity is now going to be created artificially. You know, we could have to the point on the floor here, you could have 10,000 of these things made in an hour. Like the trajectory of it is going from you would experience this thing you wouldn't even really understand to everybody's going to have their own religion. Effectively. Mm. Right. Everybody's going to customize and the algorithm's going to tailor it specifically to your usage pattern over your lifetime. how powerful that's going to be. how susceptible the network participants will be to this effect of the network itself. It's so fascinating, this thing that you're talking about, John, that how emergent it will be to have two-way communication where we're sharing these things. So not only are we all, you know, individualized, democratically, algorithmically snowflakes, but we can now transmit our snowflake to every other snowflake, and they can transmit theirs to ours, and we can look at everybody's.
Yeah.
Like, some crazy stuff's about to happen, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I many, many years ago, I had to do community service, and I did it at a local church. And of course, you know, at the end, he's the guy who runs the community service. He's gonna try to make you a member. It's, you know, gotta recruit everywhere you can. And I remember him specifically, like, pointing at his Bible and going, "We believe this is the unedited words of God." And I look and I was like, it says King James right on the cover. Right on the cover, it says King James Bible. You believe this is the unedited word of God, but King James decided what was in it. Like, how do you reconcile that in your brain? Like,
yeah.
And I think there's different types of people, and we're all guilty of being lazy in the sense that we believe things because other people told us that it's true.
Especially like when were young, when you're told things when you're young, it maybe there's, I don't want to say there's no, there's still curiosity there, but I think it's, the skepticism grows as you grow, don't you think? Like, you know, the should.
But I mean, it's, and then there's a dichotomy because, you know, you look at science, we take so many things to be true because somebody else proved it. We never did the work ourselves. But to me, it's much easier with science because it all builds off each other. And if that one person 500 years ago was just making shit up, it would have come out by now. And we would no longer accept that to be in the body of what we call science. Whereas religion has persisted despite there being so many cases where they said, well, this happened. And it's like, no, it didn't. The sun has never stopped moving in the sky. It has not happened. But you to say that you're a member of that religion, you're expected to say, I believe that did happen. Well, how? What's the mechanism? Why did the oceans not completely overrun the earth when the earth stopped spinning? Like, there's just so much suspension of disbelief required that I'm not capable of it.
Yeah. The complexity about it, like you guys were talking about, Tucker, you made the point about so many of us just kind of take the word of the science and haven't done the work ourselves. Even people that go to universities or whatever and read from the stuff. I mean, it's I hear that as from some of the shape of the earth debates I come across on TikTok. Yeah. I hear sometimes that seems to be the only argument for the flat earth, is that a person saying, well, no, the earth is a globe. The response from the flat earther is, you're just saying that because someone else said that. Yeah. You didn't actually do the work, blah, blah, blah. And then the thing that's so interesting to me is, like, is that not the same reason the flat earther is saying that the earth is flat? Because somebody else said it. You know, it's a very interesting time to be alive. I will say on the
flat earth thing, at least online, I really have to believe that 1-2% of those people actually believe the earth is flat, and the other 98-99% are just people who like
it stirs.
Yeah.
just trolls.
Yeah. It's too bad. You know, on one hand, I think it's not helpful. So it would be nice if there was some kind of, I don't like the idea that there would be a law, you know, or like regulations. It would just be nice if most, if more people didn't do it just for the sake of trolling, because I just don't think that's helpful. But yeah, the 1-2% that believe, I also think there's a good percentage in there, because I've seen it, that people like that genuinely are like, you know what? It's like the Mad Mike guy. I think that was his name. He was the guy that, you know, he was a limo driver, but he sort of taught himself to be a rocket scientist-ish, in quotes, perhaps. But do you guys remember hearing about this dude?
I don't.
He wanted to like just know for himself. He didn't want to take somebody's word for it. He's like, I'm going to build a rocket that can go up, 60 miles or whatever, so I can see if there's curvature from way up there with my own eyes. Like, I want to do this, right? And he went through like 3 or 4 iterations of rockets. The first one wasn't expected to go that high, right? It was trial and error. It was like, you know, where I got to start somewhere, right? Totally admirable approach, I think. I said he taught himself to be a rocket scientist. I mean, he worked with other people, you know, people that were like, yeah, I appreciate what you're trying to do. You want to do this for yourself. I think in general, it was a really like, it's easy to kind of make jokes about the guy. And I saw one interview with him. It was on Tosh.0. So that's an entertainment show, but it did seem like maybe he was potentially unhinged anyway. I think he may have said like, I'm a conspiracy guy, any conspiracy, I'm going to believe it. He may have said something like that. So, you know, there's that. But my point is the effort I thought was really admirable. He didn't want to take anybody's word for it. He wanted to see with his own eyes and build his own rocket and go up. And, you know, I was just kind of like, yeah, good for him. Well, you know, unfortunately his like 3rd or 4th rocket, malfunctioned on the way down. The chute didn't open and he died. So rest in peace, Mad Mike. But,
wasn't using a camera. He was literally going up with his own eyes.
Yeah. He's like, I want to see it with my own eyes. And the reason
why don't you use and look at the moon, look at Jupiter, look at Uranus if you have to. Look at
it in the mirror.
In the mirror.
Yes, in the mirror. Look at Uranus in the mirror. Look at the spherical nature of all these heavenly bodies, my friend. And anyway, I think that's sad, but I like the idea of primary knowledge. I mean, this goes back to the Cartesian problem. You know, how do you know anything that's firsthand? And it's very hard, other than, you know, I think, therefore I am. I mean, other than that, you got very, very little ground to stand on, other than your own thoughts as far as the reality of how do you know anything?
Yeah. Well, I brought up all that just to say, like, I have seen that in the debates occasionally, that someone who genuinely is curious and isn't part of that trolling, you know, population, which, again, I just don't think is helpful. I wish there was more of the just, you know, cordial conversation, someone asking genuine questions like, how come this, you know, like my own experience, I mentioned him a few times. We know somebody who's a full-on conspiracy theorist, flat earther, you know, the moon landing didn't happen, all of the things. And I think he asked me, if we're spinning at like 1600 miles an hour, like how come we're just standing here, you know? And like, I didn't have an answer for him, but I did my research. Like, oh, that's such like an interesting term anymore. I did the research. Anyway, I looked it up. I didn't settle on whatever Google threw out. You know, that's such an interesting thing that you can Google something and it's so sophisticated that, you don't even have to click on an article many times. You know what I mean? You can just, it's just here, here's the paragraph that I think you want. And not only that, I'm going to highlight the sentence that I think is exactly what you're looking for. Isn't that fascinating? But I don't think it's responsible to just settle on that alone many times. I think the responsible thing is to look through a few sources, right? Anyway, but you know, so that's where it was kind of explained as like the atmospheric thing. It's the same way that when you're in an airplane, we've all been in airplanes, the three of us.
Yes.
You're going like 500 miles an hour. You don't feel like you're going 500 miles an hour. You can hold like a cup of water, and it's not just like flying out of your hand. You know, everything is moving at 500 miles an hour. You feel the acceleration.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's the big thing. People don't correctly understand the difference between velocity and acceleration.
Yeah, and it's like, it's, you know, in other words, like if every morning started with the Earth accelerating to 1600 miles an hour, we would feel that, but that's not how it's working. It already, the acceleration is long in the past. I don't even know if that's the right way to say it. The point is, it's not accelerating to 1600 miles an hour. It's already doing that. It's been doing that all of our lives. Everyone alive now, through all recorded history, right? Like, I mean, I don't know. Is there like fractions? Is it a consistent speed? I don't know. But even like,
there's a tidal effect that slows your rotational speed over time. But
it's not enough to, like, you know, again, it's not, in, you know, to go back to the airplane analogy, you feel slowing down. You feel, you know, when you land airplane and you're slowing to zero. You don't feel that on the Earth, you know, like that made sense to me, you know, when I read that in the few different articles, and then I moved on. But, you know, I don't think I could say I did my own experiment to prove that. I read things based on other people's experiments.
Well, they use the helicopter thing a lot too, you know, where, what if a helicopter just took off straight up and hovered there? You know, the Earth should be traveling underneath. And it's like, no, because the helicopter was already traveling that forward velocity. It already has that velocity of the Earth when it travels up. It's already traveling that fast.
Well, there's a difference between airspeed and ground speed. I mean, you're in a fluid that is moving at a certain rate. The fluid itself, not you or not the helicopter, but if you're in the fluid, like in the river, like if you were on one side of the river and you want to cross the other side of the river, you're not going to reach, if you're in a boat, you're not going to be able to go directly across from where you started. You're going to go downstream. So even though you're only going across to the other side of the river, you're going to move downstream at the rate of the river moving downstream. You'll get to the other side eventually, but it's way, way downstream. Right. So you have to account for these multiple effects simultaneously.
Yeah. It's like the shared hallucination is that we decided zero is like starting speed, because it would probably be too much, much more complicated to say, well, starting speed is 1600 miles an hour. So everything after that, right. It was convenient. There's so many things in this shared hallucination that are helpful because it is convenient, you know, money, you know what I mean? Like, it's very convenient, but does it indicate like absolute truth? Probably not. Right. It's the shared hallucination.
It's the lack of
understanding. So people are playing upon a game of lack of understanding. They're trying to find edge cases to an argument that's well established that most people take for granted, and they're not well thought out in how to defend it. And it's true. They are relying on the thought and judgment of other people. And theoretically, if a bunch of people thought something incorrect, they would follow that reasoning as well, or lack of reasoning, and they would just follow the groupthink. So I think it was a useful tool to point out. You better know your sources. Like, if you're going to spout something definitively, like the Earth is a sphere, like, you should probably know why, and not just because it was in a book somewhere or everybody else says it's true. I mean, there is a fundamental philosophical question here that it's valid, I think. I think most of it, like 2%, if that, are genuine believers. Everybody else is just having a laugh. But the effect of the thing, why it became viral, I think, is because it plays a powerful role in uncovering what's actually happening, which is this giant network. And we're leveraging the ideas of a very few number of us to extreme proportions. And this is our adaptation. This is our fitness as humans, is leveraging the disparity between physical power and informational power. We've talked about this, I think, in the past. Information can be transmitted without loss. If I give you an idea, I don't lose mine. If I give you my apple, I've lost my apple. Okay. Yeah. And number two, we can share this with everybody at light speed. There's no downside to sending it to everybody. Why not copy all and reply all, right? It doesn't cost me anything to email more people. There's no downside to sharing this information. It just becomes a huge network effect, whereas physically, I can only use my shovel to dig so big a hole in my lifetime. If I started every morning when I woke up and it's ended every day when I fell asleep, I could only move so much dirt. Think about how much dirt has been moved by Newton. Just his brain. Think about how much dirt on this planet was caused into motion, moved from one place to another, relying upon the ideas of one human being.
Yeah.
400 years ago. So the accumulation effect is what humans are taking advantage of a abstracted layer of thinking or understanding this culture that we have. We share the culture intergenerationally. It's historical. It passes down and it adapts. So we have this powerful tool that's external. Going back to the conversation at hand, what is external? Do our minds project this out there? It's a projection of your mind into the real world outside of your head. The abstraction of a story, having a story that is told that gets embedded into your subconscious. It was transported from me to you. It's outside my head. I mean, they're very weasel words, but it's like a way of conceptualizing this. I think that does have some fruit bearing potential.
Well, how if you could sit down with Newton today and go, your discoveries on gravity and motion in the future will be used to produce energy, specifically electricity, he'd look at you like you were insane. But we actually have countries in Europe who have figured out, I think they call them tower batteries or something like that, but basically you have solar during the day, right? And they use some of that solar electricity. They've built these huge towers with basically cranes all the way around them. And when the solar is producing energy, they use that energy to lift these huge concrete blocks up to the top of this tower. Well, guess what? At night, when the sun goes down, they slowly let those weights down, and the same motor that pulled them up now produces that electricity that it consumed during the day at night when it's needed.
Wow.
I love that. I've heard the same thing, by the way, Tucker, with mine shafts. I heard they're doing that with mine shafts.
And it's such so that a way, cool.
You don't have to build the tower if you've already got a, you know.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's what kills me about like the whole stance against renewable energy and how it's, you know, there's lobbying groups who have created this whole narrative. Well, the batteries are as bad as anything the gas does. Well, it's like it's not a monopole solution here. There's different ways of doing things. And if you can accept the fact that there's a better way or to try to create a better way, then you'll do it. But if you accept the fact that, well, pollution is just part of industry and it'll always be there and we just have to deal with it, then yeah, it'll always be there and you'll always have to deal with it.
Right.
It goes back to my text that I sent the other day. Move mining to the moon. Pollute the shit out of the moon. Nothing lives there. You know? Yeah. You don't need the EPA involved at that point. Dump that river of toxic sludge on the moon. Just, there's better ways to do things. You just have to be willing to accept that change.
Indeed. Well, I did a time check here. We probably should wrap up. It's just the time flies by so fast anymore. It's just craziness. But maybe I think there's still more to dig in. Well, I will say for anyone listening, next week we won't be around, but we're going to dip back into the archives and from our call-in episodes from the call-in platform, CALLIN, not not the name call-in. So we'll throw the part two of three episode on the evolution of human consciousness. It's great because, you know, so we have talked about consciousness before in podcast form, but we continue to have new things. You know, there's so much to talk about. So the evolution of human consciousness conversations is, I think, quite a bit different than these last couple that we've had here. But I believe after that one, I think there's at least one more we could squeeze out here. So we'll decide what we want to do with that. But yeah, really great stuff. Per usual, you guys love it. Any final words before we wrap up here?
I would just say the beautiful thing about consciousness and the evolution getting us to where we are at today is that it hasn't stopped.
Yeah.
And it's where we're at today is not where we're going to be 100 years from now and flying spaghetti monster in the sky willing.
Yeah,
100,000 years from now, it won't even look like humanity anymore.
Yeah, can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah, I think the take home of the importance of these conversations is in the growth curve of humanity. This is an area we have a lot of progress to make, which is exciting. It's not a knock. It's something that, like a concept of a global awakening into some kind of shared new metaphor, shared culture that is superior to all that came before it, I think is exciting. I think it drives innovation. You know, there is something there, I think, that we're scratching the surface of. And I like how the levels of scientific scrutiny are coming to play, and experimentalization, and you know, people not taking the word of others for it, like trying to dig down to what's below the surface. So that's where we're at. I'm highly optimistic, and I think the growth curve favors the awareness angle of one's own consciousness and subconscious duality.
Beautifully said. Yeah.
You either evolve or you get left behind. That's kind of nature.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And I'm so grateful that we can have these, you know, these conversations with three of us versus just for my own part, anyways, I'm, as much as I love thinking about this stuff and in my own inner homunculus, like it's very fulfilling, you know, countless memories of being in the shower and just like, wow, this is so cool. But what my point is, like, I just don't think it would be as interesting if it was me by myself, just like, hey, here's my thoughts. Some people got that. James Fordor, great job. Science of Everything podcast. Like, he's just a one guy. He just hears my things. I just don't think I'm that kind of narrator, I suppose. So thank you guys.
Just to put a point on that, which I think is beautifully put, you know, he's doing research and he's collecting other people's thoughts. I don't think he really comes at it as an opinion piece, whereas we are coming from a poetic opinion side. We're all in supposition land here, but that's where we're growing from. I take it to heart, John. The listener is as important as the speaker, and we're all trading off in these roles. So it's evocative to know that I could not come up with the words that I speak unless I'm engaged with you two.
Right.
This is what works. This is how it works. This is the only way it comes out the way it does here. I'm sure, you know, everybody can sit and do their own contemplations and come up with something, but it's never as good as when we're doing it live. You guys and me, it just feels like the flow state is under our feet and we're able to run around like kids in a playground.
Yeah.
And I can't get that on my own. I just can't. I don't know if you guys, probably not, but being able to get that playground moment with my mind, with you guys, and this virtual engagement we have, it is, that's this thing. That's what I'm talking about, this part of awakening that the humans of the planet are still looking forward to. It. It's like when you've heard your favorite song the first time or watched your favorite movie, you can't ever go back and do it.
The first time.
I feel like, man, when I hook somebody up with a great movie, a great song, I feel guilty. Like, I wish I could be you. Right, jealous, excuse me. I feel jealous. Like, I wish I could experience this for the first time again. And so I look forward to this concept of consciousness and awareness of one's consciousness to be the thing, the next big thing that really unlocks, you know, humanity's potential.
Yeah.
I got to say, I think it's cool. And I had this realization that I want to say the seed for this podcast was planted in Daigle's driveway on several occasions, where it's like I'd show up to drop something off to him or pick something up, and then for the next hour and a half we're just standing in his driveway like, here's all my shower thoughts from the last 6 months, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And then like you met Bob and you guys started your thing, and it's like it came together in a way that was very organic, and it was just like, what if we just took this and aimed it just a little, like it's not laser focused, but if we aimed it in a direction and just ran with it, what would happen? Well, you get 5.5 episodes of Contact. That's what happens.
Yeah.
But I love that. Yeah. I love the fact that it's a long form. It's embracing long form to the nth degree that we have an infinite form. And it's nice to have that compared to, you know, how clipped and compressed other forms of communication get. But I like embracing our long form and having an open-ended conversation. To me personally, I think it's endearing. And as long as you know what you're getting into, you're not going to get a conclusive summation of what we just talked about every episode. And it's not going to be in a nice little package with a bow. It's going to be an ongoing organic process that grows over time. I think that's the beauty.
Yeah. It's a lot of the, we're going to discuss things from the basis of our shared scientific knowledge, but I think it's good to leave some of the what ifs in there. I mean,
for sure.
That's where the interesting stuff lies.
Yep. Yep. Totally agree. Awesome. Well, yeah. So if you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review. Just do the little bit of obligatory stuff there. And, you know, we'd love to hear from you as well. So sendingpoets@gmail.com is the best way to get a hold of us. And we'll just close here with this beautiful quote from John Adams. You will never be alone with a poet in your pocket.